billion dollars on an annual basis. So it's has a significant impact on our economy. Industries also, the regulated companies employ over 20,000 people on an annual basis. So the overall mission, is to ensure safe, reliable, and adequate service at fair and reasonable rates as per the statute. Looking to the organization of the commission, we're a fairly small agency. You can see the org chart is not terribly complicated, identified by the functional units there that that I described that correspond to the nature of our work, quite honestly. We have 50 employees plus five commissioners. So we're one of the smaller state regulatory commissions around the country on a per capita basis, particularly if you compare us to comparably sized states. We're well down the list. And even if you add in our public advisor or public advocate colleagues at the Department of Commerce, we're still well down the list. So good bang for the buck here in Minnesota, I guess, is the way we're looking at it. Our operating budget is about $6.2 million, and well over 90% of that is for salaries and rent. We have no real significant program costs that are incorporated in that operating budget. We do have responsibility for administering telephone assistance program, which I'll talk about also a little bit later. That, of course, is a program that provides credits for low-income households, eligible low-income households, to make to keep their costs of providing telephone service affordable for them. Looking then to the commission itself, there are five commissioners. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They're appointed for 6-year staggered terms. And in making the appointment, making an appointment to the Public Utilities Commission, the governor is to give consideration to certain criteria. And I don't have it in the slide, but I'll read it for you. It's fairly brief, just to give you an idea of what the statute requires. The governor is to give consideration to persons learned in the law or persons who have engaged in the profession of engineering, public accounting, property and utility valuation, finance, physical or natural sciences, production, agriculture, or natural resources, as well as being a representative of the general public. So that's the general set of criteria the governor is to employ in appointing persons to the commission. Looking on to the next slide, then no more than three commissioners can be from any one party. We currently have three Republicans and two Democrats. One commissioner, at least one commissioner, must be from outside the metro area. And the a commissioner can only be removed for cause, and that's a little different than a cabinet agency. The commission, I should say, is deliberately structured to have a significant degree of independence. And the intent is that, and the reason for that, I guess I should say, is that so much of what the commission do is really quasi-judicial in nature. In many respects, the commission acts very much like a court. It has to make decisions in a judicial manner. And I guess I'm moving on now to the next slide, which lays out the statutory functions. In its quasi-judicial role, the commission must make decisions based on a formal record, according to the dictates of due process. In evaluating utility rate requests or terms of service, in determining those, approval of large energy facilities, resolving competitive disputes among telephone companies, all of these proceedings deal with specific companies, a specific company or companies, and the decisions do not apply necessarily to the industry as a whole. So they're really focused on the parties that have come before them bringing the issue, and the commission is asked to resolve that and make a determination. So functions very much like a court. Commission also, though, has the ability to promulgate rules, and we've done that, and we're actually in the process right now of just initiated some rulemakings. And in that capacity, it functions more as a legislative body. in that the rules, of course, apply across the industry to all companies in that industry. And also, the commission does have some administrative responsibilities. It has the authority to investigate issues, excuse me, and it also has some responsibility for seeing that the provisions of the statute are enforced. So, in a sense, the commission sort of has elements of all three branches of government. Because it is independently structured, and deliberately so by statute, the commission is also held to some specific standards of accountability. I guess the two sort of go together, independence on one and specific accountability on the other. And the next slide kind of lays out what some of those accountability standards are. Commission is subject to the open meeting law. All its meetings must be in open. Deliberations must be made in open. There are specific requirements dealing with conflict of interest that apply to the commissioners that are above and beyond what normally apply to state employees generally. There are specific employment restrictions that apply to public utility commissioners. There are detailed ex parte communication prohibitions. Parties that have matters before the commission cannot discuss those issues with commissioners independently, sort of off the record. Everything has to be done before all the parties in a way that all parties that are affected are aware of. There are very specific requirements in that regard. Decisions must be based on a formal record. A commission relies on the Office of Administrative Hearings to develop that record. Anything that involves matters of contested fact or significant policy issues usually are referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Administrative law judge will develop the record and refer the matter back then for final determination by the commission. But that is a very important part of our process as well. And finally, all decisions must be in writing, must be issued in writing, and not only setting forth what the decision is, but also explaining the rationale for the decision. I might also mention that all decisions of the commission are subject to appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals for matters coming up under state law. The code of conduct naturally is to enhance the integrity of the decision-making process, to enhance the stability of regulatory process as an economic institution here in state government and in the state of Minnesota, and to instill faith in the provisioning of utility services, which of course are critical services for every citizen. Our funding is handled primarily through a specific authority the commission has to assess utilities for the services provided. Virtually 100% of the commission's expenditures during the course of a normal year are recovered through that assessment process. We keep track, our commissioners and staff, as well as our colleagues at the Department of Commerce, keep track of the amount of time they spend on certain dockets, and that is all recorded, and it goes into a billing process where the utilities are billed and the funds are recovered and then returned to the general fund. So in terms of the budgetary impact, we recover virtually 100% of what we spend. And as I mentioned before, our operating budget is about $6.2 million. In terms of telecom activities then, major activities in telecom, nature of telecom regulation has changed. When I first started in utility regulation many years ago, telephone companies used to come in for rate cases, and the way they were regulated was very similar to the way energy utilities were regulated, very, very comparable. That's all changed. There's been a major policy shift in the country. Telecommunications Act of 1996 is probably the most significant example that moved towards less regulation in telecom, and that has been followed. That approach has been followed in most states as well. So the way we interact with telephone companies is a little bit different now than the way we interact with energy utilities. The Commission's primary focus these days is ensuring competitive telecommunication markets in Minnesota, and also making sure that telephone services are of the highest quality possible. So that tends to be the primary focus of the Commission's activities with regards to telecom activities at this point in time. The authority of the Commission in telecommunications is focused on landline telephone companies, the larger ones, the CenturyLinks or Quest, formerly Quest, types of companies, as well as the smaller independent companies. Most of those companies, virtually all of them, have adopted something called an alternative form of regulation plan. This is a plan that they develop and bring in for Commission approval, and that approach, which is provided for under state statute, state law, allows for considerably greater pricing flexibility for certain services, does require Commission oversight, does require filings by the utilities. They have to keep prices and in terms of service information on file for the public. But it is a different level of regulation than we see on the energy side. There are also entities called competitive local exchange companies, CLECs, which are competitive providers of local service, and there are a large number of those in Minnesota. And then there are also inter-exchange companies, which are basically the long-distance companies, and we have a large number of those as well in Minnesota. Telecommunication services that PUC does not regulate includes a number of items. Cellular and satellite telephone service or paging services are not regulated by the Commission. Coin or public pay phones, phone services in hotels and restaurants, the internet or internet service providers are not regulated by the Commission. Cable television services, rather. That's one we get a lot of questions about from various sources, but that is not regulated by the Commission, nor is voice over internet protocol services. So, as I said, the primary focus is local landline services. Then in terms of energy activities, the main categories of responsibility there are three. First of all, is setting rates and this involves typically general rate cases. We have, for example, now you probably read about, there's Xcel has just recently filed a rate case before the Public Utilities Commission. That process sets in motion a fairly elaborate set of proceedings that culminates in the record being developed, and within a 10-month period after the initial filing, the Commission must render a decision in these rate cases. These are public processes. They typically attract the attention of a lot of interested parties, formal parties, as well as members of the public. The Commission goes to considerable trouble to have public hearings, to invite public comment, and also there's a significant portion of the process involves the evidentiary hearings where the formal parties will present testimony, present evidence, the evidence will be reviewed and cross-examined and evaluated by all the parties. The Commission very much relies on the active engagement of parties in these proceedings, because it's through that process that we get to the true issues and get to the truth, we believe, and that record development process really helps to focus those issues. So it's a process we very much rely on, and we believe it works extremely well. Commission also has planning responsibilities in the energy area, resource planning, where larger investor-owned utilities and some of the generation and transmission cooperatives will present long-term plans. They'll look out 15 years as to what they think their needs are going to be, and then they'll they'll compare that to what their resources are. You know, how are they going to meet those needs? Do they have the adequate generation? Do they have access to a neighbor's generation source? Do they have adequate energy efficiency? How are they going to meet those needs? So it's an opportunity for the commission and, again, public and interested parties to look at how utilities are operating, whether or not they're planning adequately, and so on. That is done. The resource plans are done on a company-by-company basis. We also have a process for transmission planning where the utilities generally, as a group, get together and look at the transmission needs in the state of Minnesota and present a plan. And this is all, both of these are done on a biennial basis. Every couple years they'll file these. And that allows the commission then to be looking ahead to see what are the needs coming down the road, what measures do we need to be thinking about in terms of addressing them. Also, as I mentioned before, the commission has responsibility for approving the need for determining the need for and location of large energy facilities. This involves the certificate of need process, which the commission has had authority for quite a number of years, and then also the site and route permit authority. For a number of years, up until 2005, that authority was at the and that function was carried out by the Environmental Quality Board. But in 2005, a law was passed and adopted that transferred that authority to the commission. And a part of the thinking, I believe, at that time was that it made sense for both the need determination and the location permitting process to be done by the same agencies, because obviously there are parallels between, there are a lot of correlating issues there, and we believe that combination has worked well and made some sense, and it made the process more transparent for the public, and that's something that we really put a very high value on. Looking just beyond the sort of the requirements of what's going on in the state of Minnesota, fairly recent development has been looking at transmission planning on a regional basis. A number of years ago, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission created something called regional transmission organizations, and the thinking of the FERC at that time was to create regional organizations that provided for planning on a broader basis, more than beyond just state lines, in order to gain greater efficiencies in the use of generation facilities, transmission facilities, and so on. The RTO, Regional Transmission Organization, of which Minnesota is a part, is the Midwest Independent System Operator, or MISO as it's called. And this is a major focus of our attention as well, because their planning activities affect to a very significant degree the operation of our utilities in Minnesota here. So it's something that we have to pay a lot of attention to. And then finally, our Consumer Affairs Office, as I mentioned, mediates ratepayer complaints concerning utility or local telephone services, deals with you know, let's say bill issues, service issues, you name it. They get well over 20,000 calls a year of all types, and are quite successful in helping consumers obtain credits and adjustments for errors that sometimes occur. Another important aspect of consumer affairs function is a fairly recent one, is the the creation of a public advisor process. In the proceedings where commission is required to cite a large energy facility, say for example a transmission line, there can be a large number of landowners that are affected by that, and they take a very great interest in the commission's decision-making process. But a lot of those folks don't have a good understanding of what the commission is or how it functions. And so we've determined that it would be helpful to create a public advisory role to actually work with the landowners, with the affected people, to explain to them how the commission makes its decision, that it's not like a county board or a city council. We're geared differently. We're in the process where a commission is reviewing a site permit or a route permit, it really is functioning like a court. And it's important for people to understand that. Sometimes it's difficult for people to understand that, so we thought it was important to create this role to help them have maximum impact, and to help them understand how they can have a maximum impact into that process, and so that they have a clear voice. This is part of the commission's effort to try and make our process as transparent as we can. So that's been an important new development, and we're very hopeful it will add significant value. Finally, the Consumer Affairs Office also regulates the cold weather rule, which of course limits shutoffs during the cold weather, the heating season, which we're in obviously today, and also the Consumer Affairs Office administers various telephone discount programs, the telephone assistance program, as I was mentioning to you earlier, that provides credits against the bills of households that are eligible on an income basis. So that concludes my formal comments, I guess, and discussion from the slides. I know Chair Heidinger had some additional comments she was hoping to be able to make, and we have an agenda meeting this morning, so she'll probably not be able to stick around for the whole meeting. But
very good, Chair. Well, I have a question for you,
yes, sir.
Mr. Harp. First off, before we get to Ms. Heidinger, I see we have a couple legislators with questions as well. One thing I think would be helpful for this committee is if you could explain or give some context to why, in the world of telecommunications, why are landline telephone companies and cable companies regulated or treated differently? For example, you regulate landline telephones like CenturyLink here in the cities, obviously, whereas Comcast, which provides telephone services, is not regulated. Can you explain that so people can have a sense of what's going on there?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if I could tell you exactly why. It's just a matter of, it's a policy choice that states make. In some states, there is state regulation of some of those services. But by and large, it has to do with sort of the way the industry's evolved. The telephone industry, as I mentioned before, evolved from environment where they were regulated, and for many years they were regulated to the same degree, as I was mentioning, as we have for energy services. That's changed because of the way the technology has changed, whereas the cable providers really came from a different part of the industry. They came from entertainment and other services that were never traditionally regulated. But what's happened over the years is that these communication technologies have merged. Telephone services and internet services and computer services and cable services, there's been this sort of confluence of technologies that has sort of blurred the lines as to how those industries should be treated. So I think that's that explains why there's a difference. Should there be a difference? I guess that's a policy question that I'm not, it's above my pay grade to answer, sir.
Very good. Representative O'Neill, would you like to ask a question now? Is it for you? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I actually have two or three questions.
Sure, go for it.
Can you speak to the five commissioners, their salary and their workload? Typically an agency has got one commissioner, you have five commissioners. The other question is, the energy companies had brought forth some concerns in the last biennium about streamlining some of their reporting. And there was a bill that was brought forth that didn't make it all the way through because there was more of an agreement made between the PUC and the energy companies that you would work on streamlining some of their duplicative reporting. Can you explain to us if that's happened and sort of report back as to that process, and have you taken a look at some of their reporting and heard their concerns?
Mr. Haar?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, just on your first question, you asked about the commissioner's salaries. Salaries are approximately $88,500 annually. I might add that the salaries for commissioners in comparable size states is right around $112,000 annually. The workload is comparable to those other states. The commission has responsibility for decision making in these cases involving the industries I was talking about. Certainly a full-time job. We have, if anything, the workload I think has been increasing over the years. The intensity of issues in the energy area particularly has been growing with more frequent rate cases, federal developments that have had an impact on the industry, the creation of the regional transmission organizations I was telling you about. It is a full-time job, and we do have meetings on a weekly basis, sometimes a couple of times a week, but the typical MO is the commission has its agenda meetings on Thursday mornings, and at that time we have a full slate of dockets that come before them for their review, the commission allows parties to come forward to address them and so on. So and obviously that varies from meeting to meeting, but we've had typically around 2,000 filings annually. Probably a third of those require a significant amount of commission time. As to your second question, and please, Chair, jump in if there's anything you want to add. But as to your second question, yes, we have looked at those issues, the commission has had review of resource plans. I believe that was the focus of your question, and has adopted alternative reporting requirements for certain utilities, cooperatives primarily, G&T cooperatives that have a smaller load, have a smaller presence in Minnesota. So those reporting requirements have been adjusted. We've just recently established those, and we're sort of looking to see how that's going to develop, but we believe some significant changes have been made.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Chair. It's just a real quick question, kind of building off the question you had. The one you asked hit most of my questions, but I just wanted to make sure I was understanding is that you regulate the phone lines that are landlines, the old traditional ones, but if it's a phone line from a cable company, you don't regulate it, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. I'm just going to go back to your slide on page 3 where you talk about some of the major activities in telecommunications, and the point, one of your bullet points here talks about a policy change in the 90s about deregulation and reliance on the market, and I'm just going to ask you if you can just maybe expand on that a little bit and provide some further explanation, and then I'll have a follow-up question.
Very good. Mr. Hart?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, the primary change, their policy change that I was referring to was the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. That had a major impact on moving telecom away from sort of traditional regulation towards greater reliance on the market. Now, there were still issues related to dominant carriers. So you had incumbent phone providers who provided access to the local, to the end user. And there were a whole series of issues that had to be worked out in terms of figuring out how access to delivery of those foreign services over those incumbent facilities could be done on a competitive basis, and allowing competitive local exchange carrier CLEX access so that they could actually function. That created quite a project for us in the late 90s. to sort through all that, and not only to figure out how it works, but how do the costs get allocated. And actually, we're still sort of dealing with that issue from time to time. That's one of the continuing issues in these cases. So, but it was a policy change that was made at the federal level, and it had an impact at state level. Student Minnesota and a lot most other states had their own version of that that sort of followed suit. We had legislation in the 90s about that same time that created the opportunity, for example, for phone companies to adopt alternative forms of regulation, the A4 plan I was talking about earlier, and recategorizing services, categorizing some as subject to rate control, rate determination, others that were where the companies were given substantially greater flexibility in determining rates to allow them to be more competitive. So I think the thinking was at the time that the telecom industry, because of the nature of the technology, sort of what I was mentioning earlier, had changed so that there was more opportunity for competitive entry, and that sort of the old one service provider, the monopoly service provider model, really didn't work as well, that there were opportunities for competition to provide services at a cost-effective way, and that could be relied on to protect consumer interests. Well, as I say, and that's the direction we've gone. There have been issues with sort of dominant carriers, and that's one of the reasons why commissions like ours has continued to play a role to make sure that things are being done fairly. And occasionally, the commission is called upon to deal with issues relating to competitive issues. That's really a significant part of what we do now in the telecom area. So that maybe is a lot longer answer than you needed, sir. But
Mr. Chair, perhaps this would be an opportunity for me to talk a little bit about what the challenges are that we face in the telecom area because of this shift, I would say, in the way in which matters are regulated. As all of you know, it doesn't matter very much whether you pick up your cell phone and place a call, or you use your landline to place a call, or you're on your voice over internet. In certain respects, how that call moves through the system is transparent to you and hopefully rings at the other end regardless of what your destination phone is. And so that interrelationship among the systems is very much of concern to the Commission for a variety of reasons. One is the consumer protection aspects of it, that regardless of which of those services you're using, you do want the phone to ring at the other end of the line. And there are within a competitive market, there are instances where carriers are not eager to be transmitting calls to far-end users because of the way in which the payment works among these various companies. In other words, a wireless company or a cable company that wants to terminate a call with a landline, there's payment mechanisms that are in place there. And certain calls are more expensive for them to place than others. And we want to assure that there is a fair pricing and fair access. The federal government is very much looking at this, and we want to be sure that the consumers have the opportunity to place those calls relatively transparently and on a non-discriminatory basis. And we do have reason. One of us, I hope not. One of us to believe that there are issues concerning that dropped calls and so forth that may be tied to the way in which the funding works. So that's of concern to us. Interconnection also. All of these systems do need to interconnect, and there has to be a fair mechanism to assure that all of the companies have access to all of the other companies so that voice systems are transmitted. Obviously, we want consumers to have a choice of products and services, but also at a price that they can afford to pay. And this is very much a concern of ours because in Minnesota, telephone has been regulated since 1915. It's a very long period of time, and between 1915 and well into the 80s, we were largely a landline-based system. A lot of investment was made in copper wire to run to virtually every home and business in the state, and that is an infrastructure that has tremendous value. Well, as landline users drop off, and we have seen a significant drop in the number of landline users, particularly at home, or if any of you have children over the age of 12, you know their use of landline is negligible at best. And yet there is an investment there that has to be maintained in order for this system to continue to work well. It has public safety implications. At times when we may suffer from storms or other disruptions of service, landline is a very reliable system, and we want to make sure that it's maintained, it's available, and it's affordable. How do we do that as the number of end users of landline services continues to drop off? And also, as Dr. Haar referenced, we make our decisions on an evidence-based basis. Who's going to represent the interests of all of these different types of consumers and customers in our proceedings to assure that we get a full picture of not only the impact of changes on residential customers, but small and large business customers that still use landlines for a variety of reasons, in addition to assuring that there's access to the growing demand for broadband. I think, as you're all well aware, and we'll hear more from the broadband access group, really a school, a medical provider, a business throughout the state can no longer function very well without high-speed, reliable access to the internet. How does that play with these historical telephone systems that we're used to, that we already have a large investment in? And where is the balance there between those things? So those are the kinds of challenges that we continue to focus on as we look at the changing role for telephone regulation at the state and federal level. To the point about, you know, where did cable go, I think in large part there was a decision when there were mergers among some of the large cable companies. We basically have two cable companies that nationwide are the dominant providers, and they were allowed to combine both delivery and content into their protocol. That's had some dramatic impact on the competitive nature of other industries. How does that all work itself out? We certainly don't have the answers to all of that, but those are the kinds of questions that we continue to focus on to assure that ultimately that the consumers have the level of reliable service that they've come to count on.
We have a couple more questions. I have one for you, Ms. Heidinger. Is it the role of the PUC to ensure affordable universal access to telephone service throughout the state?
It is part of our role, yes. And to that effect, as Dr. Haar stated, we administer a program that helps to provide support for low-income customers to assure that. There are also funds available as broadband is expanding to assure that there's access to broadband for low-income customers and so forth. So, yes, we do have some responsibility in that area.
And do you have concerns with respect to deregulation in terms of whether that responsibility is followed through with?
Certainly we have concerns about that, yes. And particularly, you know, I think it is a challenge for the landline companies because as their number of users is dropping, many of them would like to get out from under the obligation of being the carrier of last resort. And yet we're very dependent upon that, and as you might well imagine, it's the most distant telephones that are the ones that are the least profitable for them, but they're also in areas that are least likely to be served by other types of telephone service.
Good, thank you. Representative Simonson, I'm sorry, you have a follow-up there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I forget, I wanted to come back to this, but and this may have been a question that I should have asked yesterday, but of course I didn't think about it yesterday. But maybe you know the answer, or maybe Mr. Haar knows the answer. But yesterday we talked a lot about broadband and the goal of covering 100% of the households by, I think it was 2015, which represents a sizable investment. So my question is, in the interest of consumer protection from that aspect, who then, if not the PUC, is regulating the broadband, both the installation and then the subsequent use of it?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Haar.
There is really no regulation per se of that. I mean, the provision of those services and of that infrastructure investment is largely, you know, driven by private investment decisions, decisions by the providers of those services. And I believe the current announcement or recent announcement on possible creation of some sort of public-private initiative as an attempt to move things along in that regard to overcome some of the obstacles that are involved in that decision-making process.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know which one of you wants to answer this question, but you know, having affordable energy costs for all Minnesotans is very important. And I'm always very concerned about when I see, you know, a request for a rate increase from one of the large public utilities. Could you just briefly tell me a couple of things? One, a little bit about the scrutiny that goes through there. And two, how often do you modify or deny outright some of these requests? Because, you know, over the last number of years, private industry has really tightened up their ship in terms of really watching costs and everything else. And I'm concerned that utilities are doing the same thing, and that anytime we do get a rate increase, it's entirely justified. And then I have one other question after that.
Yeah, Dr. Hart.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Let me, Mr. Chair, let me take a crack at that. When a rate increase is filed with the commission, it's accompanied by literally thousands of pages of documentation on every expense that the company has and its projected need to raise capital and the charge it would have to pay to get that capital. And that begins a process of very thorough examination of those records. And the goal is to determine how much money does the company need to have in order to meet its reasonable expenses and to attract the capital that it needs to fund investment in infrastructure. And that, I can say that simply, but it takes literally hundreds and hundreds of hours of our staff and the staff at the Department of Commerce, as well as any other interveners, to pore over that documentation. In all of the large rate cases, it goes to an administrative law judge. All of the testimony in support of all of those expenses and capital is subject to cross-examination, and it's pre-filed so that the companies have to put in writing what all their rationale is, as do the other parties. At the hearing, the parties are all cross-examined, and the administrative law judge then will make very detailed findings of fact and conclusions about each element of the expenses and the capital. That all goes into what their revenue requirement is. Then there's another entire portion of that rate case that looks at how should those costs be allocated among the various customer classes, which of those costs can be directly allocated to a class and which have to be spread and on what basis. And then after all of that is done, there's a determination of how much should be paid monthly in a basic charge and how much should be tied to usage. So it's a very detailed process. Now, if you were to ask me, are we absolutely certain that every single penny is justified, I can tell you within the ability and time of this, the staff that we can dedicate to it, it's very thoroughly reviewed. And that's why, although the interim rate requests are by statute required to be at essentially the level that the company requests, that after this process, I don't believe there's been a time when the commission has granted the full increase that the company has asked for. And that varies in the percent that's awarded, and then the customers have refunded to them any amount that was charged through the interim rates that's ultimately not justified through the contested case proceeding. Dr. Hart.
And I was just going to add, Dr. Hart, about the amount the commission ultimately approves sort of on an average, and looking back, going back several years on rate cases, I would say the average in terms of final approved rates is somewhere like 55% to 60% of what the utility initially asked for. That will vary from company to company, but if you look at the broad average, it's somewhere in that. I would say it's somewhere in that range.
Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Do you, as a Public Utilities Commission, have any control over the junk fees that are, you know, so often listed on our bills I speak in terms of things like facility fees and, you know, other things like that. It seems like lots of times you look at your electric bill or gas bill and you have the amount, and then 10 or 20% more is what I refer to as junk fees. Nice way to make a little money. Do you have any control over that?
Dr. Hart?
Mr. Chair, well, you may be referring to additional charges for riders, that sort of thing, for cost recovery purposes. And those are come about as a result of legislative provisions, statutory provisions that allow utilities to cover costs, for example, for transmission infrastructure investments or requirements for other kinds of infrastructure investments to deal with emission reduction, that sort of thing. These are provisions that, where they're deemed to require some sort of special recovery mechanism, and those have been passed into law in recent years. So that's probably where the vast majority of them come.
Those costs are scrutinized,
Ms.
though.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Those costs are scrutinized when the company requests a rider to cover emission control or transmission. They have to also file that request. Either there's a cost reconciliation at the end of a certain period, or the structure for which costs they're going to include has to be approved by the commission. So it's not it's not unregulated, it's just regulated differently.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Helpy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Haar, I've asked you this before, I'll probably ask you it again. I'm just curious about the telecom aspect of the PUC and what percentage of the workload overall you think PUC or telecom represents today, and is that shifted any employees that were doing telecom to energy, given the greater impact of energy and I would assume on the time of the PUC?
Dr. Hart?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, the nature of the workload has changed with the changes that we've talked about that I mentioned earlier. I'll say the vast majority of the filings we get still today are telephone filings. We still, in terms of absolute numbers, the majority are telephone filings. In terms of the amount of time that staff and commissioners have to spend on cases, I would say the majority of the time spent is on energy matters for a lot of the reasons we've been talking about this morning. And yes, there have been. We have looked at staffing needs. We have made some changes, and there has been some reassignment or adjustments made, and we're continuing to evaluate that as we move along. We want to make sure that we're covering the priorities of the agency, and we want to make sure that we have adequate resources to do what we need to do in telecom without sacrificing the broader priorities. So it is something that we're constantly evaluating.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Haar, got a percentage of time or of workload you think is telecom versus energy?
Dr. Haar. I'm sorry, you asked that in your first question. I should have responded. I would say probably in terms of the amount of staff and commissioner time, it's probably around 30%.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to something that Chair Heidinger outlined with us, and I think it's really important because it underscores, from my understanding in our conversation, Mr. Chair, where this committee will have some purview, and that is in the telecom area. When you take this device and you call, if I'm going to call Representative Metza at his home up in the greater parts of Minnesota, this phone will go to a satellite. It will then be downloaded into a landline system. And most likely be routed through a co-op because there isn't a CenturyLink type provider that's up there. And if we don't maintain that landline system, none of these devices are going to work the way they do today, and none of these devices are going to work on the cable systems or any of the other kind of voiceovers because they rely heavily on an area that people continue to abandon the landline system. And you can see that by how thick your phone book was 10 years ago to how thick it is today, with the number of people that are maintaining landlines. And that is a point of contention between those who do not have to pay the fees, as was discussed earlier, to maintain the landline that since 1915, the telephone system, as we traditionally know it, has been regulated. There's additional fees that are on there that are associated with maintaining that system that others in the competitive market don't have to pay. And where the rub comes in is where these folks have to pay the landline folks a fee to connect and terminate calls, and the compression that happens on that with the expectation that the landline system has always been there and it will always be there because it's just always been that way is something that this committee, I think, needs to really keep in mind as we move forward with our discussions and with the future of how telecom works not only in the state of Minnesota but across the country. And I guess I would ask Ms. Heidinger to either validate what I said, correct what I said, or add to it if I'm in error on any of that.
Ms. Heidinger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I completely agree with you. I think that is the challenge that we face and that the landline companies face, as well as looking at how should those costs best be allocated. And at this point, I don't think we have good answers. I don't think allowing the landline system to be given up is the right solution. Those copper wires have a lot of value. But what's the proper mechanism to assure that the system is reliable and maintained is a challenging one, particularly because the state has, the federal government has determined, for example, that internet service is not communication and subject to state regulation. So we've got those issues. There are challenges, no doubt, in the questions that you've, in the points you've made.
Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up on that. And when we talk about the stratification, and you've talked about Comcast here and CenturyLink that has a large presence in the Twin Cities area in greater Minnesota, where I'm from, or others, the co-ops are very, very heavily dependent upon to deliver those kinds of things. And those co-ops are owned by the people who subscribe to that service. And so we're putting direct costs on individuals to maintain that system so that I can call from St. Paul to talk to Representative Mensa at his home. He pays for some of those kinds of calls because he's on a co-op system. And I think that we can't lose track of the fact that it's these big corporations that are out there. It is homespun cooperatives owned by the people who subscribe to that service. As if it was a farm co-op or any other kind of co-op, there's skin in the game at the local level. And if we're talking about access to all Minnesotans on this, we cannot lose track of preserving those co-ops in greater Minnesota as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that I'm, I need to excuse myself. The commission meets at 9:30 and our agenda is busy this morning, so I apologize, but Dr. Har will continue to be here to take any questions.
Very good.
You may
well,
have.
We know where to get a hold of you.
Yes, you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know this is probably an energy committee. Excuse me for it, but I'm not on the energy committee. And since I have you here, this is a complicated question, and I'm only asking just a brief statement from you in terms of as we think about a 20-year, 30-year plan in terms of energy in the state of Minnesota. Had a lot of conversation about this the last biennium. A number of things that, you know, that this legislature has passed that made it a little bit more difficult for energy producers in the state of Minnesota. Do we have the kind of baseload capacity as we look forward and we have a desire to grow our economy, add jobs? In your opinion, we look at various energy types, how long it takes to permit to get anything done, and we've got a war on coal in this country. In your mind, where are we at in terms of baseload capacity if we look out 20 or 30 years with what we'd like to do in growing manufacturing and other parts of our industry?
Dr. Har, you want to take a swing at it?
Sure. Well, I don't get questions like that very often, so appreciate the question. That's obviously very broad in scope a very important question. No doubt about that. It is something that the Commission does look at in our resource planning process and evaluates, as I was mentioning before, company by company, looking out long term to determine, really, basically, to try and answer the question you just posed, and that is, do we have adequate resources to meet the needs that we see? Now, your question implies, you know, do we need to go beyond that, or are there other directions and so on? And some of that comes into that process, but by and large, it's focused on you know, what are the needs of this company is based on its best projection of what its needs are going to be to serve its load, its service territory, and all the things that are going on around us. I think, by and large, Minnesota is in very good shape in that regard. I think, you know, the utilities here are responsible about addressing that. And one of the game changers here in recent years has been the creation of the regional energy market through the regional transmission organization. That never existed 10 years ago, or was just beginning to take shape at that point. That has changed things dramatically, because now there's an energy market out there where utilities can offer and buy and sell. By and large, our utilities, you know, generate their own electricity to serve their own load. That's still by and large what they do, but that option is now out there, and that has offered some alternatives. So is that issue being addressed? I think absolutely it is. I think our utilities are. The commission certainly here is committed to that, and I believe that's the case for other state commissions as well. Should energy policy be a topic of discussion broadly and to address the issues, I think that's an entirely legitimate question, and it's something that every state ought to be looking at on a continual basis.
Very, very good. I don't see any other questions. Members? Oh, Representative Mason, sorry.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Haar, my original question just was to ask you what some of the toughest issues that you're trying to deal with right now, and obviously the commissioner started on that. Two things in what I'd like to ask you, maybe to continue, is one is I think the transmission. I know that you've had a number of hearings on that, and so my question is, how do you deal with transmission modes, particularly when they do not benefit the state of Minnesota? You know, what are your obligations, and what are you looking at for some of these lines trying to come through the state? And then the other thing is, work at it from that perspective first?
Dr. Hart?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's somewhat of a hypothetical, because really the lines that the commission has been presented with really have to date have all really addressed reliability issues in the state of Minnesota. That's been the primary focus. That's been the primary interest of the commission to address those needs. One of the things that I think has to be mentioned in this regard is that the transmission infrastructure in our country there really wasn't adequate attention given to it for a long time for various reasons that I won't take time to go into right now. But it was for that very reason that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission decided to create regional transmission organizations. The hope was, I think, on the part of the FERC, was to create mechanisms that would address that issue, to get transmission built so that generation resources could be used most efficiently, so we don't have to build unnecessary generating plants, that delivery of power to load could be done in the most efficient manner. And as I said, so far to date, the projects that we've been presented with, the commission's been presented with, are really to address reliability issues that affect Minnesota. Now, do they carry broader regional implications? Do the systems that are being built in Minnesota perhaps enhance reliability in other parts of the region? Yes, they do. That's the nature of a transmission grid, that there's an interdependency there, that if you improve reliability in one part, it's probably going to carry benefits more broadly than that. But the focus of the projects to date have been on mainly the issues in Minnesota.
Representative Mason, do you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Haar, I guess I'm thinking that I do foresee that we are going to be dealing with issues that where the transmission might not benefit Minnesota. So I guess the question is, what is the latitude that the Minnesota PUC has in making decisions within this new regional organization?
Dr. Haar?
Mr. Chair, very good question. And it is an issue that state commissions are discussing. I mean, we're part of a group that is very active. We're part of an organization that is very active in it before the Midwest Independent System Operator, other states in the footprint. And this very issue is one that we're looking at and determining what are, you know, the state's authorities. How should the states be coordinating on these issues? How should we be evaluating projects of this nature? But the reason this is becoming an issue, and I'm sure it's implicit in your question, is that the industry is changing, the needs are changing, and really there are efforts being made to expand the scope of this of transmission planning on a broader basis to address broader needs and to address national needs. The Department of Energy has authority called. Has to do with something called National Interest Transmission Corridors, where if the Department of Energy makes a determination that there is a critical need for transmission between point A and point B that's not there, it's not being built, the states aren't taking adequate measures, they have authority to see that it gets built. So there are policies in place. Now, they haven't exercised that authority yet, and states aren't anxious for them to do that for the reasons I think you can understand, but they have that authority, and that's part of sort of the dynamic in which this is all occurring.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you, Dr. Haar, for the information provided.
Thank you.
Members, just a little bit of lay of the land as where things are at as far as committee procedure. This concludes more or less the overview portion of the committee. We do have a couple bills in the queue that will likely bring forward next week, either Wednesday or Thursday, so we'll send out an email. If there's nothing to review, we'll cancel a meeting, but we'll likely meet next week for purpose of reviewing a bill, either Wednesday or Thursday, but we'll keep you posted on that. So with that, the meeting's adjourned, and we'll see you later.